So welcome to today's EU Scotland, EU AGI Scotland seminar. And before I begin, I just want to comment on what a great turnout. Great to see so many professionals, industry people here. That's super. We are most glad to have you. And just continues the successful series we've had here. So, today's talk is given by Glenn Hart, Head of Research at Ordnance Survey. He's going to attempt to explain linked data and the semantic web to us. And Glenn has degrees in both computer and natural science, and also a background in development of real-time control and also expert systems, and then on to programming various support tools. Has worked for several years in engineering consultancy, looking at software reliability in particular. Glenn then moved into the GI industry in the early 1990s and was involved in laying the early foundations of OS Master Map and the UK Digital National Framework, DNF. And more recent work has focused on the semantic web and vernacular geography and, of course, linked data, about which we're very grateful to have Glenn here to talk today. Over to Glenn.
Thank you. So can you hear me in the cheap seats? Good. I'll talk more quietly then. Actually, this is a good turnout, but then I sort of fear but you'll need it. So I'm here at Research Ordnance Survey, and I have had a sort of a bit of a career change. You might wonder why, and that's largely because they found me out. They still haven't quite sussed me in this one yet. Changed today, of course. As Head of Research, actually this is probably a better description of my job, which is the day duties of a cat herder, and I can probably best describe my job as a failed cat herder. if anyone's been in charge of the research department, they know exactly what I mean. And what I'm going to talk about today, anyway, is, and I'll take it in this order, a bit about linked data, then something on semantic web, and if I haven't ground you down by that point, there's still a few left. I'll try and look at some of the implications for GI and this industry. And I want to emphasise at this point, by the way, that linked data is often seen as separate from the semantic web. Really, it's just part of the semantic web. In one sense, it's a bit of rebranding, one aspect of the semantic web. and it's certainly the bit which is growing most at the moment. And the thing is, basically ask questions at any time. So, what's this all trying to do? Well, I like this analogy that Kent was created by Tom Heath, really, which is, if we look at, as I said, and this is the Scottish transport network, then what would it look like if settlements were data? And that's what it would look like. All the roads and railways and things would disappear. In other words, you've got all these islands of data which are being created, often at great expense, and which we try to exchange, but we do that in incredibly inefficient ways. So if I did build a railway from Edinburgh to Glasgow, then it would probably be at one gauge. And if I built one to Dundee, I'd probably build it to another gauge at the moment. That tends to be how we do things. And even when we have some standards, they tend to work well within a particular community. So things like GML are very popular in the GI community, whoever the GI community is. But if I go and give some GML data to the BBC, they look at me rather strangely. And so they don't understand this whole thing. So that's really the problem that linked data and semantic web are really trying to solve. It's how do we make this easier? How do we build some roads in our data? So the first bit is about linked data, is it? We go back right to the start of the creation of the web, Web 1.0, the one that we're all used to, then as invented by good old Tim from Berners-Lee. Then what you've got is essentially a web of documents. We tend to call them HTML pages nowadays. Some of them can be rendered from databases. But fundamentally, they're a web of interlinked documents. And that's what we've managed to achieve an awful lot with that sort of basic, very, very simple, actually, under the technology underlying this is actually pretty simple, boils down to it, which is what's made it so successful. And just for historical purposes, the very first message that was put on the web was Berners-Lee, so didn't actually know what he was creating at the time, so even he admits that. But if we then look at the web of data, what we get is something which looks quite different. There is lots of different formats, and we've even included things like PDF, because a lot of government agencies at the moment are publishing data in PDF format. A format, by the way, that Chris Gutteridge at Southampton University recently described as an abomination to the human race. With respect to publishing data in that form, I sort of agree with it, because it actually makes it completely inaccessible in any easy form. But people are doing it. And in our little industry, we've got things like shapefile, GML, DXF, and so on. And then you've got statistical data using entirely different formats, and so on. And there are about as many different formats as there are different data communities, and you multiply that by a few, and you actually get the total number of formats that are out there, which we know about with very few. And people generally know very few. They just know the ones they're working with, and they're all hopelessly incompatible to a degree or other. And this is really what the Linked Data Web is trying to get over. It's trying to create this sort of picture, if you like, which you'll see several times. So I like to reuse things, it's easier than reinventing. The state of the linked data web. So it's basically linking data using the same principles that we use to link documents, but now linking it on data, and at the data level. So not the data set level, but actually linking between different bits of information. And the next bit of the presentation show how that works. Oh, how it works. There's one thing I'll tell you about this presentation, by the way. So I put it together a little while ago, so it hacked together from a number of different ones, and I can then never quite remember the order of the slides, so sometimes it's going to surprise me too. It's always a bit of a voyage of discovery for me too, especially when we've got lots of slides. But anyway, basically this is how it works. So if we imagine that we've got four different data sets here, one that's very dear to my heart, which is a pub review one, and I'll say that for the sake of argument here, I'm a pub reviewer. And it's just got, so it's referring to a pub called the Hampshire Bowman, and it just says, as review, this is a very rural pub that is popular with bikers, blah, 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 blah. And then we've got a separate data set in the good old traditional world that we can pick up in business directory, maybe it's Yale.com, something like this. And it also knows about Hampshire Bowman, but it says some different things about it as well. It says it's a pub, which this one didn't, because it's a pub review, so it sort of assumed you know it's a pub. It's got its telephone number, it says it's also a music venue, and so on. Then we've got a nice little geography database here. Maybe it's a gazetteer, places. Knows about Dundridge. Knows about the Dundridge in Hampshire. It's got location and so on. And last in the corner is a completely different one. Like I said, from MI5. If somebody seems to know about me. But what we can do is, the way that the data is arranged, it's arranged in sort of triples. So there's a basic structure here, which I'll hammer home several times today. So Hampshire Bowman has phone number, and then this bit of data. And that's linked within that data set. But then I can use that same structure to link between data sets as well. So in this case, these guys have noticed that they're referring to Hampshire Bowman, and they're pretty sure it's the same Hampshire Bowman. So they can say, it's the same as, and same as is actually quite a powerful statement in linked data. There are most of them sort of you make up. Same as is one which comes out of the box. And it basically says they're the same thing. And these guys can also then say, right, Hampshire Bowman is within Dundridge. So they can link to gazetteer data to say that this pub is within there. Now, these guys, by following links, know that not only is Hampshire Bowman has this telephone number, it's also a music venue, which they probably knew, which I forgot to tell you about. They know now for sure it's a pub, which I think they're pretty clued up on before anyway. They also now know that it's in Dundridge, and they've got now a lot more geographic information about where Dundridge is and how to get there and so on. And so just by following links of data, then we've actually created a linked data web. And that's about as hard as it gets. That's obviously lying, because it does get more complicated than that, but not a lot more complicated. So it's all based on a format called RDF, the Resource Description Format, or sorry, Framework. It's actually been around for about 10 years, and it was invented as a way of describing metadata, not to do with anything to do with the linked data web. In fact, when RDF was invented, the term linked data didn't exist. In fact, it didn't exist until about 2006, I think. The basic ideas are around before that. So it's basically an existing standard that was hijacked. So it's a W3C standard that was hijacked for this purpose, because it basically had all the right components to make it work. It can use specialist databases, like they're called triple stores, and it has its own query language called Sparkle. People like Oracle are now implementing it as well, so Oracle are also supporting it, and they're supporting their own version of Sparkle. Of course, because it's Oracle, it's not quite Sparkle, but it's close enough. And so essentially, it's to the web of data what HTML is to the web of documents. So it's the basic underlying format and standard. Just a hammer about the triple format. So it represents the data as triples, subject, predicate, and object. So, and again here, just perhaps you'll open it in Dunridge. So that basic, really simple statement is the way that we express all data within Big Data Web. And again, just explain that a little bit more. So you don't actually have to have an object. So an object, I'll come back to it, is a specially identified thing. You can also just have a literal, so that's basically a value. It could be a string, could be, you know, a number, whatever. We'd like to argue it could be something like a polygon, but we can't at the moment. And each of these things get a URI, uniform resource identifier. So they're all literally identified by URIs, so which are unique. So URIs, these are, again, pre-existing. URI offers a sort of special type of them. And that's what they look like, they're pretty dull. This is where some of the terminology in linked data is pretty awful. You can see it came from computer scientists, can't you? They identify either information resources, non-information resources, properties, relationships or associations, and let's face it, they're not great names. So, what are they? So, non-information resource. Well, here's Exhibit A here is a non-information resource, bless him. So am I, and in fact, I've sadly got the URI, at least one. Essentially, it's anything that you're interested in. Anything that you want to have some information about, or have some information about, is a non-information resource. And this does tend to confuse people, because it's definitely people, it can be animals, it could be an event like the Olympics, it could be places, it could be books or cameras, or the pictures you take on the cameras, or stories, so it's fairly ephemeral things, or web pages even, which is information about something, so isn't that an information resource? Well, sometimes if you've got information about the web page itself is a more information resource. So I'm glad that's clear. So basically, anything you want to hold information about can have a URI, be a non-information resource. So what's an information resource? Well, you'll be surprised occasionally. So properties, one of the other things that can get URIs, so that's basically the predicates, so within, same as, and so on, so they get them. Some people say they're information resources, and there can be arguments about that, but who cares? It's just, they've just got URIs. And then the information resource is, so that's the information about the thing that you're interested in. So it's the information about your non-information resource. And they can be human readable, such as a web page, or they can be data, such as RDF. And as I say, you can be interested in information resources. In that case, they become non-information resources, as well as being information resources to somebody else. And this is sort of how it works. So you start off with a client system. This is, by the way, I think my most technical diagram, almost. And you start off with a URI for a non-information resource. How do I know it's a non-information resource? Because there's a sort of convention. In fact, there's a whole bunch of different conventions. But this is the one that's been adopted by the UK Location Council, which is that you have a slash ID. So in the URI, so if it's got URI which has a slash ID in it, then it's a non-information resource. And you send it off to a server because you want to find out what's at the other end of that. And the server says, see other. So this basically gives you a 303, so it's a redirect. And it then creates a new URI from that, or returns a new URI, which is the same URI except now it says slash doc. And the slash dot says, what's at the end of me is an information resource. So it's actually it's information about that first URI, which is in this case just a pastecode. And it returns that. In this case, it's been asked to get some data, so it's returned some RDF on that. And this is sort of how it looks. This is sort of how it can start to look. You can sort of build up triples. That's what they sort of look like, if you like, in the world of the computer. So the city of Southampton, that's the URI that we've given it, that Ordnance Survey. So this is a non-information resource, the city of Southampton. They didn't even realise it, but they are. And then we've got the touches relationship, so that's a predicate. And that also gets the URI, so that's its URI. Now I can build up a relationship to something else. So in this case, it's actually saying Southampton, which is the unitary area, touches, and that's the URI for Hampshire. I'm sad enough to know that. So it's just basically collecting some triples. And then Tim Berners-Lee said, well, okay, if you're going to start publishing data, this is where it's really shit to government. So he said, in the first case, just make your stuff available, which is what government's doing. And sadly, some of them are doing this as PDFs. So make it available then as structured data, so maybe that's an Excel spreadsheet. But then maybe use non-proprietary formats, so maybe that's CSV. That's your three-star level, which is what most sort of government agencies are about achieving. And then use URI to identify things so that people can point to it. So let's publish it as RDF. And then link your data to other people's data. And that's really starting to form the linked data web. Now we've said, you also need to describe data semantically. So tell people what it is. Linked data is not terribly good at sums, though. So you won't be doing complex arithmetic with it. You won't use it for GIS operations. And the reason it's not really good at sums is because it's got no real concept of arithmetic or those sorts of complex computation. So it wouldn't actually try and do 2 plus 2 and get 5. It just wouldn't know it's wrong. And that can be a limiting factor. A lot of people have looked at that and said, well, actually, that means it's pretty limiting. And it is fairly frustrating because it means, for example, I couldn't do a query, a Sparkle query, which says, identify all the buildings within 50 metres of this building. Because that means it's got to do some sums. Unless I had an explicit relationship of everything that's 50 metres from this building. So you might start to think from a GI point of view, well, maybe it's not that useful. But actually, as we're going to show, that you can do an awful lot of useful stuff with the topological and numerological type relationships. So the linked data web has certainly grown. This is what it was like when it was sort of in its baby days, 2000. So the first time linked data was used as a term, as far as I can establish, was in 2006. And in 2007, it started to grow. So this is May 2007. That's what it sort of looked like then. 2008, it was beginning to grow. 2009, getting bigger. It's July 2009. This is September 2010. This is the last time this snapshot was taken. And I think the guys that produced this said, we're not going to do this anymore because it's just getting too big. In fact, this doesn't actually show everything that's on the linked data web. It's just found the bits that they could discover. So it's actually bigger than this as well. But as you can see, it's starting to grow quite... it's not actually exponential growth yet, but it's definitely a steady growth. And all the surveys over here now, so we're beginning to form a little hub there. So. And here's another example. This is a Birmingham City Council website, which is being powered by RDF and linked data. So they've generated this from linked data. And in fact, they've taken a number of different data sets to put this together. I always include this slide, by the way, because it's got this, you probably can't read this, but one of the, under other information, it's got this line here, Birmingham B29. Birmingham. It's not shit. I actually went back recently, because this was taken about a year and a half ago, this slide, and it's gone now. So they've obviously been told otherwise. And when I'm different. But, I mean, there are lots of other examples of people that are doing it. I mean, the BBC, as I mentioned something earlier, is now one of the biggest publishers of RDF data that there is. A lot of their website is actually backed now by linked data. So things like their wildlife pages, the music pages. In fact, we'll show an example of how we can use some of our data, some of their data. And so there are an increasing number of people that are beginning to publish data as linked data. And that includes all the survey. So last year, just under a year ago, I think it was in May, we launched three versions of, launched three data sets which were RDF versions of data that we released as open data earlier in the year. So in April, we launched Boundary Line, Cope Point, Open, and the longitude case scale gazetteer as open data. In May, we published them. In fact, in May, we published, I think it was the 50-year gazetteer with Boundary Line as linked data. I think it was October when we published the Cope Point, Open, as linked data. Since doing that, I checked just before I came to see what the usage of that was in February, and in February we were getting 1.2 million hits on our linked data sets, so people doing basically active queries against the linked data that we'd supplied. So we know people are out there using it, and we can see that by the fact that there's a little hub forming around the RS linked data on that picture, which is quite reassuring, really. So you might say, well, so what? And I use this as an example, really, of starting to say why, so what. These are what I regard as two completely pointless websites, but they both sort of demonstrate the point. This one is a traditional mapper, a mashup. It's of fast food vendors in the US, so you can see why it's pretty useless. Where they are, I've been in the States, I can't walk 50 yards without finding a fast food vendor. So why anyone would hop onto a website when it's completely beyond me? But they've done it, and it's been done in the sort of the old, you know, good old traditional way. They've taken some data, they've looked at the data, understood it, geolocated it, or maybe it's already geolocated, but they've had to sort of understand what the data was, they've had to understand the structure of the data, and then they've written some code that swiped it onto, in this case, Google Maps. And so it's basically pins on maps, some codes that's been written, and some understanding of the data format and the semantics of the data as well. This is a mashup. In fact, it's for some bizarre reason, it seems to be going out of fashion now, fortunately. There was a tendency to call mashups that were written using the data as mishups, which I can only assume was South African. This one was put together as a demonstration of what you could do with linked data. So in that sense, it's not pointless. But as a useful application, it is pretty pointless unless you happen to be just interested in this very particular way of doing things. What it's about is this, and you have to sort of follow this line of, it's artists that were played on the specific BBC radio programmes that come from a specified place. So in other words, tell me, if I give you a place, tell me what artists were played on a specific BBC radio programme at a particular time. So the first thing is, it's actually a lot more complicated than that, except it's a lot easier to implement because it's using linked data. Because actually that's just a Sparkle query that links together several data sets, and I'll walk you through how it works. So you start off with some OS linked data for Birmingham. So there's the URI for Birmingham. And then we do an L same as, so it's the same as, to DB Birmingham. Now DB is a resource called DBpedia. Now what DBpedia is, it's one of the first data sets that was put out to linked data, and it's a linked data rendering of a lot of the content, not all of the content, but a lot of the content of Wikipedia. And it's about as reliable. So it's not a great resource at times, but other times it's okay. But it's also, because it's one of the ones that's out there at the moment, it's being used a lot, a bit like Wikipedia. So we've linked it to that. Now why did we link to that? Because we want to get to BBC data, basically. And that's what that DBpedia entry looks like. So this is the DBpedia RDF rendered as an HTML page. So when they did the request for it, they said, don't give me RDF data, give me an HTML page, and it automatically does that for you. And then within DBpedia, you then link to, in this case, it's done a search and it's found broadcast, which is a group. And that's what the DVpedia page looks like for podcasts. You don't have to read it. But then that can then take us to the BBC pages. This is the BBC page for broadcast. Because the BBC at the time linked, because our data wasn't available, they linked to the DVpedia version of Birmingham. So for us to get, so if you started at Ordnance Survey, you wanted to go to BBC pages. At the moment, you have to go via DVpedia because that's what the BBC have linked to at the moment. And they are beginning to now to link to some of our data directly. And so you get, then you can just sort of see how the link goes on. So you get, that gets you into the music section of the artist, which is the page I've just shown you. You then find which tracks were played on which radio program segments at what time. And then that's basically, you know, how the sort of the query's constructed. So it's just basically by following links. And that's why it's so simple. And this is the program that it's played on. So what? Well, the so what is that, first of all, when I built those links, so when the guy did the mashup with the, you know, the fast food places, the only people that had access to that data was him. Because he took the data set, he rearranged it, he stuffed it into his application, and although we can see it there, we don't have direct access to that data. When I do it with linked data, what I'm doing is I'm building links between two data sets, and I'm publishing those links as well. So now that work that I've done in linking up data means no one else has to do it, providing they trust me. They don't trust me, they'll probably do it themselves again. So the first thing is that you're preserving links, you're preserving that sort of connectivity. The second thing is I publish them, and so they're reusable. There's actually a fourth thing here, which is that the data structure problem is reduced. The more data, if I was to try to do that, convince the broadcast, the BBC sort of program, using conventional data, then I have to understand the data formats of about three or four different data sets. Probably not published, probably not well explained. But with linked data, I know what the data format is. It's a triple. It's the same for everyone. I don't have to worry about the fact that this table has got this particular structure, this number of columns and rows, this number of fields in it, and so on. I just know that it's a triple. And that makes life really easy. It gets over one of the big problems. Because I know what their data looks like. It looks exactly like my data. They've structured it exactly the same way. The power of it is it becomes a universal data structure for exchanging information. And therefore, the amount of code that's required is reduced. It's not zero, but I'm basically reducing a whole lot of what this guy wrote as code down as a single Spartan query, or maybe two or three Spartan queries. And that's really where you start to get the power. And we're also beginning to see, just as the original web grew, we're also beginning to see now services grow up on the linked data web as well. So not all of you are old enough to, or sad enough for that matter, to remember that you could, at one point, walk into the shop, into WH Smith's, and buy something called the World Wide Web Directory. And guess what it contained? It was a list of all the websites that existed at the time. You can't do that now, because it sort of grew a bit. And so what started to happen is, again, if you're really old, you can remember something called Archie and Excite, which were early query engines. They were steam-powered, it admits, admittedly. But then you had people like these guys coming along, and so it became a lot easier. And it's a combination, actually. The thing that really made the web was a combination of the very, very easy protocol that linked web pages, and the fact there were people that were going out there indexing it and making you those pages discoverable. And the same sort of thing is beginning to happen with linked data web, except it can't happen in quite the same way. It's got that really, really easy to understand basic structure and protocol. So a lot of it is just copying the web. We use HTTP, for example. but you can't really use the Google method of indexing it. Now, one of the things is, how do we index the linked data web successfully? But there are services starting to arrive, and this is one of them called samemouth.com. So it basically tries to find things that it thinks are the same as what you've got. So if you stick in a URI, it's not very user-friendly, admittedly, but it will come back with all the sorts of things. This is a URI for Birmingham, but from the OS1, it's found within DBpedia, that one, and another thing, it's also found in a separate place in DBpedia as well, and another data set as well, which has also got a reference to Birmingham. It does make mistakes, so it did confuse at one point Iron Maiden, the group, with Iron Maiden, the torture instrument. Where some people thought it was actually quite right anyway, but I mean, it wasn't quite the same. And I mean, things like Birmingham are another classic. So how do you know that's Birmingham in this country, not Birmingham, Alabama? And I think there's something about Birmingham, actually, because this isn't to do with the linked data web, but it's such a great story, you can't miss it anyway. Birmingham City Council, again, just get it wrong all the time, these guys, they published, they got a company to build them their new website, which on their opening homepage had a picture of Birmingham on it, except it was Birmingham, Alabama, because the company had just done an image search and found this one, pulled the image, stuck it on there. So it sort of happens, you don't need linked data to make this happen, but I think it's an important point, actually, an important thing you have to be careful of when linking linked data. You really need to know that the thing that you're linking with is the thing you think it is. Because if I do a web search today, you know, using Google, Bing, whatever, and I type in something like Birmingham, and it gives me some, I want Birmingham in this country, rather than Birmingham, Bala, I've written it for a while, put it that way around, but if I did that, and I got back lots of returns to Birmingham, Alabama, I could see they were the wrong ones. If I'm a machine, I might not necessarily realise that. And so we need to be a bit smarter about the way that we do this on linked data web. Going back to principles again, another thing that one of the first things actually Tim Berners-Lee ever did when we started talking about linked data was he said, name things with URIs, use HTTP, URI so they can be looked up on the web. Find some useful information in open standard formats and link to other things. So, and those are really what's become now the principles of linked data. So give it a URI. It doesn't actually matter. Lots of different people have given different URIs for the same thing, some the same non-information resource. And that's sort of natural. That's what will happen. And the trick is now to try and link those together and make sure you're looking to the right ones. So in summary, the linked data actually does what it says on the tin. You know, it leaks data, and it's no more or less than that. The problems that it overcomes are what I would call structural problems. So the fact that I don't have to now worry about what is the structure of this thing, oh, it's in shape file form, what the hell is that? How do I unravel this data to link it to my statistical data but in this weird statistical format? Because I know that the data over there is in triple format, and I know the data I've got is triple format, so I can just link them together. It gets over that problem. It does not get over the problem of semantically linking. So saying that this thing is the thing I actually want, that's what I'm interested in, it's the right thing, and so I can use it in this particular way. That problem it doesn't overcome, so it only makes part of the problem of linking data, connecting data, easier, not the whole thing. It's not a silver bullet. I like to tell people that no werewolves died in our research. But in strict, I've got to talk about the kittens. So that's linked data. And now the semantic web, which, as I say, I argue is really a superset of linked data. So linked data is, if you like, the raw data material that the semantic web has to use. You've seen this before. So I say I like to repeat things. Here we go again. So here's the World Wide Web, as it is today, more or less. Tim Berners-Lee invented that, went away, thought himself, done quite a good job, but then came back about 7 or 8 years later and thought about the semantic web. And at the time, his vision of what the semantic web was actually quite different from what it is now, though he doesn't always admit it. So he invented this thing called the semantic web. And the idea of that was that in the old web pages, then it's just text. If there's any markup, it's markup to say, it's in this font, it's this pretty colour. And that's about as far as it goes. The idea that Tim had then was that let's start marking up the web pages intelligently. So here's a little reference, probably won't go read this, to Southampton. This is a Wikipedia page of Southampton. And it's saying, so he's put a bit of markup in there, that says Southampton is a city. So that's telling the web page now a little bit more about it. The machine knows what a city is. How do you tell a machine what a city is? then it can pull out a bit more. It can start to understand that web page as well as you and I, the bits of it. And use ontologies, these magic things called ontologies, to define what you mean. So in this case, we've said Southampton is a kind of city. Now, the way that he saw this going was that his vision at the time was that if the machine can understand the web pages, then it'd be great because I can now book my conference in Birmingham, and the machine will automatically book my flights and everything. It's in MIT most of the time. It knows it's a conference, so it probably knows that I want a sort of particular level of conference, things like this. Well, that's obviously bollocks, isn't it? And let's face it, it's never going to happen that way. And that was part of the problem. The vision for the semantic web was oversold. It was sold in ways that it could never actually achieve because for so many different reasons, one of them being that humans are actually quite perverse and never actually want to do what a machine tells them to do anyway. Certainly I don't. So it's a failed vision, maybe. So it's been around the idea for about 10 years. The data was in the wrong format, so all this data that was out there actually was in the wrong format. Anyway, no one was marking up web pages because it was too hard. Were you going to publish your web page and mark up everything on it? I think not. There was a bit about people then trying to automatically mark up the web pages, but you can imagine how successful that's been. It's not totally unsuccessful, but it's got a way to go. And so there's really a lack of tools as well. So the semantic web reborn. I think now actually there's increasing recognition of what value the semantic web can bring as opposed to sort of the early promises. And it is really more around linking data on the deep web. The deep web is, if you like, all that data is hidden out there on the web, which at the moment we don't really have very good access to. So people have published it, but it's just, again, just islands of little data. It's not really linking that together. So it's definitely less about intelligently marking up web pages. People are still doing that to an extent. And all the BBC pages, web pages that I mentioned, have been marked up. But they've also published that data in a more accessible format for the semantic web. And really, if you think about it, there's a lot of hidden knowledge. If we take a standard application that we write today, so when your typical database application that you write today using Oracle, whatever your favourite tools are, Java code and so on. There's information hidden everywhere. There's a lot of information about the structure and the semantics of the data hidden in the code. There's a lot of it hidden in the structure of the database. Some of it, if you're lucky, has been documented, but let's face it, it's a good day, you've been lucky. And a lot of it's actually in this guy's head as well. It never gets anywhere apart from his head. So which is why there's often so much disappointment when new applications are released. But ontologies can help to expose that knowledge. They can help to make it visible. So an ontology, it's a repository of knowledge. It's definitely independent from the data. So it sits there independently, but visible. And in at least computer science terms, in terms of the semantic web, it's a formal description. And sadly, in computer science and in semantic web, it's also normally based around first-order logic. So if you want a quick 101 now, I'll just go into those slides. There's only 300 of them with a test at the end. Or we can move on. Needless to say, because it's based on mathematical logic, it can be quite impenetrable to a lot of people. And one of the challenges, really, is how to make that more understandable. And there are also limitations because it's based on first-order logic or things that you can't describe. But probably the two most popular ontology languages at the moment out there are OWL and RDFS. And incorrectly, RDFS is a subset of OWL, which is not true. But just you can think of it as a slightly simpler version. So you can do less in RDFS than you can in OWL, mostly. But they're not quite subset. It's not quite a subset. But they're pretty close. So where they fit in. So if we go back to our typical application again, so there's my application. This question mark there isn't, I didn't know what I was doing, much other views on that. It's just meant to be a query and into my relational database. And in this one I've got information about it all over the place that I need. And if you think about what an SQL query is, for example, there's actually semantics about the relationships between different tables, which are different representations of different objects. In linked data speak of non-information resources, it's actually bound up in the code. So I only know that, I mean, although in my design document I might have actually drawn a line between two boxes, in reality, the way that's realised is by constructing an SQL query. And that query is quite often buried up in that code and the application, and the trouble in the application is it's actually a black box I can't see in there. So unless I construct, actually type in that query, which as database users we very rarely do, I don't actually understand what the structure of the data is and what the certain relationships are, what certain semantics are. Within the semantic web, when I'm using ontologies, then a lot of that data is now drawn out of the code, drawn out of the database structure and so on, and expressed within the ontology. Still not 100%. It's still a model, and it still can't express everything, so there are still sort of fake lines going to these bits. I still need to have some code that's going to have some of the semantic bound up in it. I'm still probably only going to find some of it in the guy's head or in the documentation. But a lot more of it now is actually completely visible. Because I can access ontology, and in fact, I can look at it and I can see what it says and see how it relates to the data. So the most popular act that's used is something called the Web Ontology Language, WOL, spelled out. So there was a theory actually that was linked to Winnie the Pooh, which is actually not true, but it's such a nice story, I think we should all agree that it's true. And again, it's represented as triples. Does that sound familiar? So it's actually built using the same structure as RDF. So and you will find sort of OWL predicates mixed up with RDF data and so on. It's basically all the same sort of thing. So they look pretty similar. So every mayfly is a kind of insect. Every school is a building. It's these simple statements again that make up an ontology. And RDF is a sort of simpler version of OWL, but it's not exactly the same. So a geography question. There ought to be a few geographers in here. Some of them are still late, but only just. So is Nottingham in Nottinghamshire? Guess where I was when I did this talk originally? Silence, they don't want to be flushed out.
It's a separate country of
Yes, it's going to be. Is.
Well,
Nottingham is a separate country of Hurdy from Nottinghamshire.
You could say that, yes. And that's one of the whys. So you've done the good thing. You've said, well, for me, I'm talking about the administrative areas. And in that case, Nottingham is not in Nottinghamshire. Now, if I was to take that from a different point of view of what's my natural idea of the geography of this country, I'd say Nottingham's obviously Nottinghamshire. You get some perverse things. The administrative geography of this country is so confusing that Southampton isn't in Hampshire. How many ports are in Hampshire? Answer, none. Portsmouth and Southampton are both administrative. If I'm looking at it from an administrative point of view, so if my worldview is from the administration point of view, then that's my answer. If, on the other hand, I take a more vernacular view on that and say, then actually Nottingham is going to be in Nottinghamshire, Southampton is in Hampshire and so on. And England is a country, which administratively is not. Much, I'm sure, to the joy of most of the Scots in here. We don't exist administratively as a country. But the point that I'm trying to make there is that depending on your worldview, I can interpret the same data quite differently. And that means I can build different ontologies that express different worldviews that I can apply to the same data, which might sound a bit dangerous. But actually, we do that all the time. Except we don't document and we've done it. And that means that... But also, I've got to understand that to make sense with that data, because obviously I can't do that willy-nilly. But I can use it to interpret the same data in slightly different ways. In this way, it's probably not a good example, because Nottingham is either going to be, at any one point, an administrative area, or it's going to be a more vernacular definition of a town. And I can't really mix those, so it wouldn't make sense to have different ontologies applied to that same data, either one thing or the other. But there are examples where that may not be necessarily the case. So how all this works is, basically you end up knowing more than it's just in the data, because, and this is just a sort of very simple example. You don't really have to go to all of it. Every place is a footprint, every place is a person, purpose, so I can define places. Every city is a kind of place, every city contains buildings, blocks. I can start to define cities. Every university has a purpose, education, my hopes. I do have a couple actually, I really doubt, but it's not this one, don't worry. So yours at Nottingham is a university, Nottingham is a city, Nottingham contains the University of Nottingham. So from just this information, where I've got some, so basically this is an RDF bit of linked data, so Nottingham, URI for a non-information resource, is a city, two other sort of non-information resources there. The fact that Nottingham contains the University of Nottingham, again another bit of RDF, but because I've got this idea that the university is a purpose education, from that I can deduce that Nottingham, at least one of the things that can happen in Nottingham is education, you'd hope. So I'm actually now discovering more about the data than is actually in the data, just because I start to get an intelligent description that lies above it. And so if we start to use this now with geographical ontologies, then I can start to put small ontologies together that start to tell that I can then recombine to actually use to define more sophisticated things. So I can start with basic features like city roads and things. I can have an idea of land cover. I can have an idea of land use. And if I then put those two things together, I can define what an orchard is, for example. And then you start to find that you get standard patterns for describing things. And if I know these bits and pieces, then in fact, if I know those three things about bit of land I'm looking at, I can probably deduce it's an orchard. Or if I know it's an orchard, I can deduce those and sorts of things that are going on about it. It works in sort of both directions. And the sorts of relationships, the properties that we're coming up with a lot in GI work are things like subsumption, so this is part this, well, sorry, this is a kind of this. Topology, so what are the topological relationships between things? So this is next to something, this joins it, so on. Meriology, which is just part of relationships, really, so you know, Hampshire is part of England, and so on. And then the function, the purpose and use, and those sort of, those four things used in combination can actually describe an awful lot of things in geography. Not everything, you need other things for certain things, but a lot of things can be described in that sort of way. And one of the things we've been around for some time is a simple regional convection calculus, which unfortunately, against its mathematical, it's horrible. The descriptions it uses are pretty horrible. So, if, for example, you've got one thing inside another, so whereas we just say it's within, in this particular mathematics, it's helpfully described as a non-tangential proper part. Only mathematicians can come up with that, bless them. But this is it's a well-formed calculus, and it means that we can perform sort of logic operations on it, so it's quite useful. Unfortunately, you can't perfectly represent that now, you can do a lot of it now. And so we've taken that, and we've come up with, we've certainly implemented D6 at the moment, it contains implemented six of them at the moment. And these are the ones that are most commonly used. And actually they correspond quite well to the sort of operations that you get within GIS. But remember, that if I say within here, within the GIS, I can say within 50 metres. Within this thing, because I can't do arithmetic, I can't say within 50 metres. I have to have an explicit relationship, so I have to say that Hampshire is within England, or whatever the relationship is. I can't say, give or take 50 metres or whatever. So the principles, then, are really that you've got no God's eye view of super-encompassing ontologies. There isn't one ontology out there. I hate to break this to inspire, but there really isn't one ontology out there that's going to describe everything. You can't shoehorn everything into this. And actually, one of the really nice things about this sort of technology and this way of thinking is it accepts that fact. So it says, I can't describe the world from God's point of view because he hasn't told me what it is. What it does mean is that we can each describe our own worldviews. So I can describe the way that I think the Ordnance Survey put its data together. And that's a description which is now available to you. You can either agree with it when you take the data, or you can take it and you can modify it to suit your purpose, or you can come up with your own. It's not a matter of forcing everything to be the same. But what you can do is interlink them. So where they are similar, for example, where they do share things, you can link them. So what you tend to end up with is lots of lightweight interconnected ontologies rather than one big, massive thing. And so the ontologies end up being a network of statements. And this sort of looks a bit like linked data work because it's really the same technology. And so it's all that interconnection again. And this is the sort of thing that we've sort of been working on at OS, really, which is just to do with land cover and so on. So you've got habitats and things. So you've got lots of little ontologies which we're now sort of linking together where it's appropriate to do so. I mean, I've stripped all the detail out of this, you'll be very glad to know, but I'll still be asking questions. So it's rather than one massive thing, we're breaking things down to lots of smaller ones which we can then use in different ways as well. So some of the Stanic Web, where it's slow in coming, it's certainly true. It's partly slow because the data hasn't been around in the right format until recently. And with the sort of arrival of linked data, what we're beginning to see is people starting to describe their data using very, very simple ontologies, because they still haven't really got their head around what ontologies are. But in time, we're also seeing people doing some quite sophisticated stuff as well, but that's mostly within universities. The idea that you're separating the description from the application means you're making it a lot more visible. And if it's more visible, it's more accessible, so I can understand what you've done far easier. Plus, it's therefore available to things like Spark Query engines to use. It enables you to know more than is in the data, which I hope I've demonstrated. And it's this idea of supporting multiple world views, so it's not trying to force everything down the same path. Because we know the world isn't like that. So what are the implications for GIS? Now I'd say there are two main ones anyway. One's technical. So what can we do with this? Well, sort of spanners out of the box type thing. And I'm actually not going to say much about that. And then there's a cultural thing, because one of the biggest challenges really is when you're trying to get your head around this, is it's quite different. Certainly for a computer scientist or a software engineer, it's very different from what you were taught in university. It's very different from what you were taught when you got your first job to build a database. Some of the rules sound awfully similar, but they're a bit different. So the technical implications, and this is my only slide on the technical side, first of all, there's a less focus on geometry. You know, the very fact that I can't do sums is going to force me away from just doing stuff that's arithmetic. And what that really means is that all those guys out there that are producing GIS systems are usually going to lose their jobs overnight. If I want to do really complicated spatial analysis, I'm not going to use this technology. It's the wrong thing. I might use that technology to get to a point where I can do the analysis, but I'm not going to use this to do the analysis. So it ain't good for everything. But relationships between things become much, much more important because they're the links. If you think about it, the links that you make between your data and between other people's data ought to be as valuable to you as the data that you've got in the first place. Because if they're not, if you've got good data but you make bad links, then actually you're devaluing your own data and other people's data too. So things like topology, numerology, next to you within part of, and so on. These become a lot more focus on those, and a lot more trying to implement standard understandings of those things. The cultural changes. First of all, where do we as a community fit in? And one thing I will say, because I'm going to do a bit of a down on the GI community for the next few minutes, because I'm good at doing downs, it's easier, is that GI community is just one of all the other communities out there. Basically, we all think the same way, really. And it's also about the way that we develop standards and move forward in the future. But, so I guess, where is GI community? This is where down a bit starts, by the way. This is something that I see crops up time and time again. I've seen it at an AGI seminar in London. Numerous other occasions, people have quoted 80% of all organizational data is geographic or thereabouts. But sometimes, for variety, they'll vary the percentage between, say, 75 and sometimes as high as 90%, I think. But fundamentally, the message is the same. And isn't that great? Because that shows how important we are. But 80%? Do I really believe that? Well, not really. In fact, fact, I usually use the word bollocks, actually, because I think that really gets across the point more. I did try to trace this back. And it's one of those statements that you never ever see a reference to, not ever. And actually, I got back to about the early 1990s. I have my thanks here to Milky Hackley at UCL, who managed to get it back even further than I did, because we had a conversation about how ridiculous this was and the sort of competition, so you could get back first, I think he won. But anyway, he eventually got it back to this 1986 brochure published by the British, municipality of Burnaby in British Columbia. So it's a local authority putting out a brochure, clearly a peer-reviewed document. Well, surprise, surprise, it's a local authority. And wouldn't a local authority sort of deal with lots of local data? I'm sure there's a clue in the name, isn't there? So, actually, I can believe that's right about Burnaby, and I can believe it's right about Edinburgh City Council and lots of other local authorities, because that's what they do. But is it true about a pharmaceutical company or a bank? That banks certainly have geographic information, but I don't think it's anywhere near 80%. And if we look back at this thing, again, I like repeating things, and start to look here, well, we can find geography in there. A lot of DBpedia, which is this massive hub in the middle, a lot of that is either people or places. So yeah, there's quite a lot of stuff there. This is GeoMeets. Somewhere down here with OpenStreetMap, although strangely there aren't very many links to it. So I can never find it, there's a lot of that. But anyway, that's down there somewhere. You've got OSRP forming a bit of a link. But all of this around here is things like music and broadcast information. Down here, most of this down here is life sciences. There's a whole chunk of stuff up there which is statistical. And so it goes on. There's only little bits which are actually, there's quite a lot there, but it's nowhere near 80%. And that's just, one way of trying to assess that. I wouldn't say it's a very accurate way. I wouldn't like to use that as a way of generating a new percentage. But it's a nice little visual demonstration, but maybe it's not 80%. So as all that, GI is obviously not important at all. Well, actually, it is. Clearly, GI is important. It's just that if we overstate its importance, we end up with this really geocentric little sort of view of the world, and we become a nice little sort of insular group of people. And the standards that we develop reinforce that too, because we've got some, as an industry, we've got some very successful standards. These are just, obviously, some of them, there are others. And we build SDIs on using those standards. The trouble is they're not known outside the geo community. And actually, if you think about it, one of the biggest assets of geography is it can link other data together. So if we publish our data in ways which aren't actually easily accessible to those organisations whose focus is not on GI, but they need GI, then we're making it hard for them. In fact, there was a really nice statement, I was here earlier today doing a careers talk, there's a guy from Esri, and he made a nice sort of comment that really GI should be invisible, because people should be able to use GI without actually being conscious of it. And in fact, when you're using Google Earth, that's almost what it is. You're looking at a map, you're not really conscious that there's a lot of GI behind that, maybe. And that's how it should be. But we make that difficult by the standards that we create. And so, there you are. This is my picture of the GI community. A little island. It's not a very big island, either. It's a little island. And it's quite heavily populated. But it's an island. And the only saving grace is, in a sense, is you've got all these other little islands as well. And that sort of looks like, actually, that first picture I showed right at the start of what the Scottish transport system might look like if you took the roads away. So sort of going back to that sort of statement right at the front. Each of these little islands are a little community with its own standards, trying to communicate, but not being very good at it because it's got its own standards. In other words, and the reason that is that when we create these standards, we use the technology we had at the time. And the technology we had at the time didn't have a way of universally expressing things. We sort of have that now with linked data and RDF. And so we've got to relearn certain things. One of the things that we have to relearn is that, well, so this is my version of what Charles said earlier, which is, he said, make it invisible. I say it's glue, and no one looks at the glue. But glue is pretty important stuff if you're building things, unless you want to use nails. Sometimes it's good. So it doesn't mean it's not important. But it's the way that we view it, which is. And to give you an example, if you consider GML, what GML does is it wraps everything up. It wraps all your data with your geometry. What actually makes us special is the geometry a lot of the time. And all the other stuff that's wrapped up is pretty inaccessible. So if I'm a user now that wants to use some GI but isn't really part of our GI community, so maybe I'm the BBC, maybe I'm working for a bank or something, I've now got to understand not just the way that I structured the polygon. And I think actually it's perfectly reasonable that he does need to understand that, because that's actually, you know, a complex thing, and it's something which is peculiar to GI, largely. And so they need to understand how we construct those things as producers of GI. But all the other stuff actually is just other stuff. It shouldn't be wrapped up with the GML. It should be more open. And in a linked data view of the world, I can do that. I can disaggregate the feature and the GML package and just make everything more accessible. So, and I'm coming to the end now. So really, dot link data is a means to exchange information. So that's really one of the things. So use this universal common format rather than invent our own over time. Describe the data in ontologies, so make it more visible. Your interpretation of that data more visible. Be part of the data infrastructure, not an SDI. Surely that's where we should be, isn't it? There's a lot more data out there than just the pure geography and geometry. And certainly it's my strong belief that things like the linked data web actually is a data infrastructure. And it's one that's a lot more universally related, because you can really see in that structure that by following links I can get from actually sort of life sciences stuff, talking survey through some peculiar route that I can do it. But that doesn't mean that GI doesn't have a role to play, and that we should forget everything we've done, because we can use the knowledge that we've got, the standards that we've developed, and just modify them so they work in a better way. Don't throw it all away, because actually we've got a lot to offer. We can certainly develop spatial ontologies, which is another area where we should have some expertise, and make those accessible to others. So, my conclusion is, well, there's lots of stuff going on. Linked data center here has grown. Whatever happens, there's going to be a lot more linked data out here next year, even more 5 years' time. It's sort of got to that point where it's past critical mass, I think. 2 years ago, I was still not that convinced that it was, I was confident, but I wasn't convinced totally. I don't see it failing. Just because it's not just because it's got government money, which is actually usually a pretty sure way to ensure it does fail, but simply because there's so much going on outside of the government as well, which is building as well. The semantic web itself is beginning to stir again, but it's still got a long way to go. And as a community, we need to embrace this technology, take it on board, because then actually we can really make a difference in this wider web. Because we can make our knowledge, our data, far more accessible. And that, I believe, is it. There you are. Thank you. Now, can I have a beer now?
Oh, sure, yes. Right, what question? Bruce is right in there and very keen, obviously.
Yes, yeah. Bruce is getting very wound up by this and is going to launch in. I would actually turn things around, Glenn. I would say that linked data has its place, its part to play, but if it's going to be successful, it's actually the G that's going to make it successful. My reason for saying that is as follows. I have two concerns with this. One is that computer scientists love throwing away things that actually work and replace them with things that don't. And I think there's a real risk that 40 years of tried, tested, and reliable database management technology could just be chucked out the window. You know, I mentioned XML databases and other things such as that. But much more importantly, I think it encourages a view of data curators and librarians to build concordances between everything and everything. And in principle, that's a good thing. But actually, if you think about it, it becomes an absolutely impossible thing to do because you're trying to build concordances between so many data sets. And I've been to so many meetings over the years. I remember going to one with the library community many, many years ago where they seriously suggested that the way to connect data together was to create an extension to the Dewey Decimal Classification System such that every geographical object had a sort of 9.3 point 1 point whatever. So I think what the G gives us is actually the ability through coordinate systems to connect things. And it's actually probably the saviour of this stuff, because otherwise you've got to sit and you've literally got to start connecting things together, because you can't be sure that the Birmingham, Alabama is the Birmingham, England until somebody's sat and looked at it. So I think we actually, it's the other way around from the picture you painted. I think the G is the saviour and the linked data is, yeah, it's nice and we should be doing it, but the only way we're going to be able to do it is through the G.
Okay, the two things, one was on the technology and... this is a statement I don't agree with, but it's such a great statement, I've got to repeat it, really. It's Nigel Shambel at a general government meeting, once got up on stage and said, relational databases are dead, but they just don't know it yet. Now, I don't believe that, because so many people try to kill relational databases that they just don't really go away. And, you know, first of all, we've got a whole stack of technology that, even if everyone today said, linked data, it's the way to go, 20 years' time, we'd still have some stuff working on that technology. So the first thing is, it isn't going to completely replace things. So one of the challenges, actually, is how we can get these things working together. You know, that's a challenge for Inspire, for example. Inspire sort of charging on their particular route. But it's having to live in a world which is very, very different now from the one that it was envisaged working in. You know, you do get a lot more data that gets crowdsourced, for example. How's it going to cope with that? Now, in terms of your second point, which is around, you know, well, perhaps we should turn this around. Now, first of all, I sort of agree to a point because it's certainly, you know, I'm concerned that these links are not going to be made by themselves. You will not see that happen. At least if you do, there's going to be an awful lot of upset within there. And, you know, there's already an awful lot of bad links that have been made. What I do see is that... what you should get, I think, what you should start to get, is areas of trusted data. So I can trust this data set because I knew someone actually has gone to the expense of building sensible links. And there will be organisations, you know, it's one of the things that we're necessarily seriously thinking about trying to do. And the question is, which data set should we link to, and why should we do that? And we do it already. You know, and you know, the truth of the matter is, we do it already with existing technology, except we do it incredibly inefficiently. So when I do address matching, that's actually what I'm doing, really, except every time I do it, I throw away the information, so I throw away that explicit link. This is about keeping those links. So, you're right, you're never going to get a linked data web where everything is interconnected, and it's going to be exactly like the web. You know, I mean, does anyone have any idea how much of the web Google actually managed to index? Can we come up with a figure?
10% or less.
It's less.
Yeah.
It's about 7%. It's all they managed to discover. Thank God. And that's what it's going to be like with the linked data web as well.
Why is that?
Because so much data is inaccessible to their spiders. Some of it's in databases which they never see. Some of it's not really, you know, it's just nobody links to it. So you're only going to find it. Yeah, someone links to it. It's kind of our linked data, by the way, because it brought our servers down when it spider went berserk on it. So you are never going to get that massive linking. What I do think you'll see is certain data sets that really count being linked, because we're already seeing that. You know, we're beginning to see things like ONS data being linked to RS data being linked to some of the sort of health and education data. That's government data. We also begin to see it coming outside of that as well, people like the BBC trying to do things too. But it ain't going to be perfect, I admit that, you know, it's not, it really, really isn't a silver bullet.
Yeah, I'm certainly not saying don't do it, because I think it is valuable, but I think we shouldn't paint it as this sort of panacea that's going to solve happen, because who is going to link this data together? It's difficult enough to get organisations, even government organisations who are mandated to collect data, it's difficult enough to get them to collect data and make that available. Okay. To then link it to other people's data, that's always where the failure happens, because an organisation will collect its own data, but it's then not going to spend money with it. So I think it's just so many issues.
I think Keith Murray said, head of the infrastructure, said as soon as the semantic web can pay his wages and do his account every month reliably, then he'll believe in it.
Well, actually, he does now, interesting enough, because he's one of the biggest converts. He's actually gone to Inspire to try to talk to them, well, actually successfully talk to them to loosen some of the standards that they used at the time, so that it was actually more amenable to link data. So one of the things that they dropped was the idea of making URNs mandatory, and instead of going through URIs instead. So it could become more compatible with linked data. So he's someone that saw the light, but he did actually say to me as well, I'm glad you raised this example. Yeah, he's thinking, yeah, Glenn, you were right, so. The points you're making are perfectly valid. You know, and I wouldn't want people to go away from this talk thinking, you know, linked data is the panacea, because clearly it's not answering all the questions. And as I said, I myself, it doesn't answer the question about, you know, how you make those links. It makes it easier to do it because it makes the data more accessible, but it doesn't do the hard bit.
Yeah.
Some of the semantics can help with the hard bit, but they're just helping. You're still, you know, you're still not going to get you there the whole way. But, yeah.
I would argue it helps a lot when you know the typical geographic query that people are doing is in Google. You go in hotels in, you go into your conference, hotels in wherever.
And it tells you about Alabama.
know as well. I mean, there's also kind of the context of other stuff you've done and where you look, the URL, you know, your IP address of where you are, and it kind of makes up its mind and kind of does it so far, stuff like that. But also, I'd say crucially, that's what folks are paying money for. You're looking for a hotel, you're paying for a service, so folks will pay you to be part of that service and be found and discovered.
A lot of money.
So it's not some big new technology thing that requires new standards and loads of money and loads of new machines and loads of shiny servers and stuff like that. So it'll just fund itself and it'll happen because folk will build an iPhone app or an Android app or whatever that will just take advantage of it. Because what occurred to me is Wikipedia is, and we have this constant discussion and your constant flame wars with people in Wikipedia and stuff. In the absence of nothing, Wikipedia is at least something. It's a starting point. If you're starting from zero knowledge, then it's at least a starting point. So I guess semantic web, that is going to be a good starting point, but so much of that zero starting point is a geographical query, even if it's only where the person is asking that
question. One area so far where the semantic web has definitely been a success is in life sciences. And that's because it's actually a lot easier to join things up, because they're working on a lot more concrete definitions of things. But you are seeing it growing outside of there as well now.
Cameron, just got to go on. I think I really kind of follow on from the last points. I think it's one of these things where it gives the impression that it's a technology looking for a home and looking for a support. I think as far as public authorities in Scotland are concerned, what we really need to do is start to think, what is this? What do we have to do? Then we're going to have to ask some very painful questions about why should we do it?
Yep.
And once we've got the answer to why we should do it, then there are going to be some hard questions about how are we going to do it, which is then going to start to lead into the obvious questions of budgeting and the cost of the whole thing. So, while it might be a good thing, we're going to have to sell this and fear what I didn't get from this was any of that. So I'm still, you know, I'm still not quite sure about the answer to some of these fundamental questions, like why should we do it and what have we got to do?
Right, okay, why you should do it is because, particularly if you're in government, bearing in mind the government's quite keen on people to make their data more accessible, is so that you can make your data as easily available as possible to the population. So how can I publish that data in a way which is as easy as possible for them to consume? And linked data has to be one of the ones that's really at the top of that queue in terms of how easy is it to consume. So if you look at the other alternatives that you've got, so say I've got some geographic information, then I could publish that as a PDF file, which a lot of government agencies are doing, which makes it very accessible. I might say, look, I'm going to push it out in shapefile, because I know lots of people use shapefile. But then if I don't know what shapefile is, and a lot of people don't, you know, I've had people phone me up when nobody can survive a date and say, they've just received last month, and they said, can you tell me how I load it into Excel? You know, that's sometimes the level of people that you're dealing with. But these are people that still want that geographic information. Or I can publish it, say, as GML. If I publish it as GML, well, there's actually lots of different GML formats out there. You know, I can't consume in the same way GML that OM Ordnance Survey published by OS Masternode as it does for another OS product, which is VectorMap District. They're both published in GML, but actually to different structures within that. And you know, one of the biggest complaints was when we watched VML was VMD was, well, it's GML, but am I going to need another interpreter for it? And I thought, yeah, I might do. Whereas if I publish things in RDF, then if I publish geographic data in RDF, I can consume it. If I've got anything at all that will consume RDF, it will consume geographic RDF. If I've got medical data in RDF, that same bit of software will consume it. So in other words, I've lowered one of the barriers for people, end users, to actually accessing that data. And okay, that's only the start of the story, but it's a barrier that's been lowered. The second, I suppose the next thing is, well, how hard is it to publish data in RDF? It's actually quite easy. And the reason it's quite easy is because the difficult bit is the structure of your data. So if your data's already in a mess, then publishing it in any form is going to be hard. Unless you just shift it out there in that state and let everyone else worry about it, which is, again, a strategy that I know some government agencies have adopted. Or you can convert it to RDF. And the reason it's easy is because it's a triple format. It's a very, very simple format to convert things to. You know, how much did it cost OS to convert all that hard data? One guy. It didn't take him that long. It was one guy, probably about 2 or 3 months' work, and the first month or two of that was working out how to do it, because he didn't know how to do it. And he's got that knowledge, that's the sort of knowledge that's being passed on to others now. So actually, in terms of cost, in terms of actually, you know, the mechanics of getting data into that format, it's not very much. So then you say, well, okay, but I still need to make it available, I still need to publish it, push it out there. Again, how much is it costing? The amount that we're, you know, our data, which is hosted by a company called Talis, it's not costing us, you know, it's tens of thousands of pounds to host all the data that we've got, which is getting close to that million triples or something, which is, you know, a reasonable amount, almost. But it's basically hosting data from third parties doesn't cost very much nowadays, and they do all the dirty work. So for us, the pain actually hasn't been that bad. I don't think it's going to be anywhere near that bad for people too. So. But obviously, you know, there is pain. It's another new thing. It's another thing you have to do on top of all the other things you have to do. So I'm not going to say that it's, you know, it's not without any pain. But all the things that I've come across adopting new technologies, linked data itself, forget the semantic work itself, linked data being one of the most painless because it's so simple.
So I've just got a question then. How do you deal with the change of the time? So it seems very static, but it's not.
Yeah.
You've got how that
You know when I had that diagram up with the pubs and stuff on it, and I said, well, that's as simple as it gets. And that's how I lied. Well, the two areas that start to complicate it a little bit are metadata and things like change over time and things. There are models out there that support that. I mean, it's one of the things, I mean, it's quite interesting you raise that, because one of the areas that have suddenly got very, very interested in the data are archivists, historians, archaeologists, and, you know, basically those that are interested in historical data. For them, that aspect is very, very important. And essentially, like most things, you have to complicate the model a little bit. But again, it's not complicated very much, because you just have a URI that says, like, this is me at that particular time. And then another one which says, this is the same thing, but a slightly different time. Never mind, there are different models to do it. But they don't get too much more complicated than I showed you, but they are a bit more complicated, because you've got to bring in this time aspect. In fact, in one aspect, it's even better for handling time than most ordinary data sets, because with an ordinary data set, you get a big lump of data. With this, I've got a whole sort of web of disaggregated data, so I can literally say, rather than reissue the whole data set, I can just say, like, this thing now has changed, this thing has changed. This is the latest version, this is the old version.
I guess it's looking at how you can compare over time, like, could have been a city from.
Yes.
But how can you look to see how it's actually, like, can you see change in the data as well?
If you put that into the structure, then yes. And I say there are different models to do that. I would say, well, one thing I'd say, I don't think any of them are brilliant at the moment, because it's early days, so no one really knows the best way to do this. No one really knows the best way to put metadata on at the moment, and so on. So there's still a learning curve there. And, you know, we've got it wrong already, you know, OS, which is only one aspect of some of the stuff that we've done. And the question is now, okay, so how can we fix it? But one thing I would say, again, about linked data, is it's amazingly forgiving. You know, you can really screw up stuff, but you're only ever screwing up the bits you screwed up, and then the rest of it almost insulated from that. You can sort of just tear out bits and put bits back in. So, but yeah, it's not perfect.
On that note, how does it, or connected to that, how does it, well, what about the geography, the actual geographic data, the points and lines and polygons and.
Actually, I just watched
it. How does linked data actually help that, or the. Right. Is that making finding those bits easier?
It makes finding those bits easier. You're beginning to see certain non-standard implementations which will also start to handle that as well. But I mean, to be perfectly honest, anyone that wants to try and do a spatial query in the way that we're used to doing spatial queries over linked data web is, quite frankly, as bad as a box of frogs. You know, you wouldn't do it. What it can do is it can represent the geometry in a standard way. And in fact, what we can do, when we've already done, if you look at the way that we've published some of our data, some of our RDF looks amazingly like GML places, because there's, fortunately, GML has a sort of historical relationship to RDF in that when they were designing GML, one of their design options was that they were thinking of going the RDF way. I only wish they had, but it's close enough anyway that it's actually very, very simple to change from GML to RDF, which means that we can take the structures that they have within GML, you know, the description of a polygon, and put that and render that as RDF quite easily. In fact, one of the things that we're trying to do at the moment is to say, right, take those OGC, ISO standards for, you know, what structure of a line is, point, polygon, and so on, and implement those now as XML data types within RDF. That's what we don't have at the moment. That's something that Oracle is certainly pushing very strongly for, so that they'll just implement that as part of their normal query mechanism as well, so it's instant supported. But you wouldn't want to, you know, actually try and use that at the moment. There are some implications. Can do that, but yeah, not a good idea. Takes too long.
Student question from Guy.
Following on from that, and following on from Bruce's preserving virtual papers systems, obviously they still are the fastest spatial query.
Yeah.
And we know that GML can be shredded into relational databases and systems quite efficiently, and it can be published quite easily. So there doesn't seem to be any way to query it, although there doesn't seem any reason. Why not, in a way? I mean, a lot of SQL spatial standards are defined, and we know that there is a lot of work being done on translating Xperion stuff into SQL. Can the same thing be done with and well, yeah, after this possibility of doing for expansion.
Well, you can. I mean, you are, as I said, you are keen to see those sort of things coming. There are sort of short stalls now that sort of supporting non-standards. It's all non-standard at this point, sort of spatial queries and so on. But I think in terms of, okay, maybe spatial querying, that might happen. Actually, I would be surprised if in 5 or 10 years' time we wouldn't see that as a standard part of most trip stores, just like it's now part of most relational databases as standard. But what you won't see is, you know, there's a lot more of a complex analysis that goes on top of that. The other reason I think it's less desirable to see it anyway at this point is because I think the whole area is developing. Again, if industry generally has got a lesson to learn, it's to stop making standards too early. Because we're always standardising on the stuff now before anyone's really used technologies. And then the result of that is that you're then tied into something which doesn't really work as well as you wanted it to. You know, I mean, OWL is a prime example of something which is probably standardised too early. You know, and if they had sort of waited a couple of years, it would probably look quite different.
I saw GeoSpark as well.
Yeah, there's a GeoSpark. That's right. The GeoSpark is the version that Oracle are trying to push forward. Which will have that sort of basic capability in it, but yeah.
Alright, I think perhaps we should maybe draw this series to a close there. We can certainly reconvene. On that note, we'll reconvene, I think, in Brass Monkey to allow Glenn to get his hotel and get sorted out. So we will retire there shortly. But there is, engage with us firstly on refreshments at the back of the room because most of them have to be used up. So do help yourself.
End of season sale.
End of season sale. But on a more useful point, I would also encourage you to engage with us offline as well. And we're always looking for suggestions for speakers, obviously looking ahead to next year. So if you have burning desires or good suggestions, please send them to ourselves or perhaps Bruce. Or, do feel free to suggest names. And before we thank Glenn, I'd like to thank you all again for coming. Great to see you. Hope to see you again next year. And I'd just like to thank Glenn for a very interesting talk on a usually hard to grasp, perhaps, subject, but has made it seem.
Especially so now.
perhaps some libation is required to let it sink in, but we'll do that shortly. Anyway, thanks to Glenn.